This is News in No Time, Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, the NAACP's choice for a new leader, wooing teachers, and the Supreme Court watch. Joining us today from our Chicago bureau is Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist. At NPR West in Culver City, California, Joseph C. Phillips, actor and syndicated columnist, and George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, joins us from Maryland. All right, folks, we just heard from Bruce Gordon, soon to be president of the NAACP, if all goes well for him in July. George Curry, what's your thought?
Well, I think he sounded all the right notes. Obviously, he'll be a strong manager, and certainly NAACP needs that. And I think also this will work better, less friction, because I think that Julian Baum becomes even more so the face and voice of the NAACP as Mr. Gordon plans to do his management thing a little more and build bridge with corporate America. So it'll probably be a relationship with far less friction than it was between Infomi and Julian Baum.
Mm-hmm. Laura?
I would agree with George on the friction issue. There's no secret that there were dueling egos in that organization for many years between Kwesi Amfumi and Julian Bond. On the other hand, it's important for the top manager of the NAACP to have a high profile. He comes in with a bit of a disadvantage because he doesn't have a profile outside the business community. And I think we need as many spokespeople as we can get. I'm sort of betwixt and between on his appointment. On the one hand, as has been touched on, he's a corporate leader. He's got the business sense. He knows about fundraising. He can bring new approaches. Takes us away from that old standard civil rights model, which I think is a good thing. But when you come out of the corporate environment, you operate a little bit differently. You may be an excellent manager internally, but in terms of, and I dare say, politics, he acknowledged that he himself is not a political person, doesn't want the organization to take political sides. But in terms of activism, corporate types tend to be more cautious. They tend to be more risk averse. It's just the nature of the beast, and maybe even more compromising. And I think that we're in a period when we need strong leaders of organizations like the NAACP to be out there on the edge taking the risks. And I wonder if he's going to be up for that.
Joseph Phillips, you heard him say that he wants to build bridges between the organization and corporate America. There are those who are critical of that kind of alliance, again suggesting that it could, in fact, make the organization far too beholden to the corporate world.
You know, it's funny. I had a figure somewhere in my office that talked about the amount of corporate money that the NAACP currently gets, and my memory is that it was much different from what Mr. Gordon said. And right now the NAACP is very reliant on corporate dollars, but as he's indicated, I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think that it's a different time, needs to be a different message, a different type of leadership. NAACP is in the red right now. He brings, as both the other commentators have stated, those management skills, the ability to streamline, raise dollars. If the NAACP is going to be effective in activism, it's got to have its financial house in order. That's important. I think it's also important that this is somebody who wants to speak to both, as he said, the red and the blue states. All of these things are important. I think that the connection to the corporate world is important to the younger generation who sees themselves as entrepreneurs. The civil rights battle now is not about sitting at the counter, lunch counter. It's about owning the restaurant. It's about being in business. It's about, as he's indicated in some of his statements before, it's about black corporations controlling pension dollars. It's about big business. And I think that listening to him, I was very excited. And quite frankly, if I can just tag on one last thing, and we talked about the ego competition between Julian Bond and previous president. Quite frankly, I think maybe it's time that we see a change, a similar change in the chairmanship. And that's no disrespect to Dr. Bond, who I have a great deal of respect for. But it is a different time, and he's been doing a lot of heavy lifting through his career, and maybe it's time for him to retire with the honor that he's due.
I totally disagree. I think that the reason this combination will work is because you have the two different styles. Julian Bond is still represent the mainstream views of most African Americans. There are people, of course, on the right who don't like Julian Bond because he's one thing. He certainly is ripping your president day and night. So, I mean, he's aggressive, and the NAACP needs to stay aggressive.
And let me ask this, George Curry, and I know that you followed the NAACP for years and years and years, and I was interested to see Mr. Gordon's answer to this. It seems to me part and parcel of the largest problem that the NAACP has is, in fact, that board is unwielding and far too large. When you take a look at Mr. Gordon's career, he walked into Verizon over the division he had it and made wholesale changes walking in. If you read Jack Welch's book, he talks about, and most corporate managers will come in when they're tapped and make wholesale changes. He won't be able to do this here. And everyone who sat in that chair privately will tell you that that board still wields a lot of power and it's difficult to deal with.
And it's unlikely to change. Yes, I've been covering this for more than 30 years, and I've always seen a lot of friction between, oftentimes seen friction between the chair and the executive director. And I don't think you'll probably have as much of that this time. But I think you can get too much in bed with corporate America. Sure, you need funding, this kind of thing, but not to the extent that it becomes hush money. And I got to say, that is certainly a suspicion on some of our organizations are not as aggressive when you need to attack organizations that they get money from. That is a danger that we always got to be on guard against.
Well, on the other side of the page, too, away from the corporate funding, you have the membership aspect of this. This is fundamentally a membership organization and has been since its inception. Membership groups, chapters all over the country, and many of those are in disarray or not in good shape, and they're lacking leadership. So I think that's one area that he could address and attack right now, right today, corporate money aside, and that also is a really important source of funding for the organization. I have a few questions about the NAACP that go beyond leadership that I haven't heard answered, and one of them is, what does the NAACP stand for? And I'd like to see him tackle that question. Is it a black organization? Is it a civil rights organization? Is it an organization that represents people of color across the board? Where do young people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s fit into this? Joseph Phillips mentioned the aspect of young people being more entrepreneurial. But we have a huge disconnect in terms of class, age, and race in this country. And if the NAACP can address that by trying to respond to all of those constituent groups, it will take it light years away.
All right, let's move on to something that so many people talking and looking at today, and that, of course, is the question of the Supreme Court, its makeup, Justice Rehnquist's possible retirement. If indeed, and we've talked about this in the past, he steps away from being Chief Justice and there is an elevation of one of the judges that has been most talked about, either Scalia or Thomas. Most people put their betting dollars on Scalia. And a conservative replaces Rehnquist's spot on the court. You don't see a shift in terms of political thought. But, George Curry, talk to me about this man, Rehnquist, and what your belief is. He's been Chief Justice for 19 years to this point and has been one who wields that chair very well, if you will.
Well, he's certainly dying-in-the-wool conservative. Replace him with another conservative, as you said, doesn't change anything. This whole fight is about the second appointment. Notice all the major decisions are generally 5-4 decisions. And so this is not going to tilt anything. It's that second appointment, and that's why you hear some groups talking about spending enormous amount of money already. There's one group said Progress for America. They already spent initially $18 million on a nominee that they haven't even named yet. So this is going to be a showdown, as we've seen with the justices so far, because the Federal Society has a plan and that they want to retake these courts, want to shift them to the right, and that's been a major thread, and they are waiting for the Supreme Court,
Are you at all bothered by the fact on both ends, conservatives and liberals have already, as George alluded to, started putting money into the belief of who they think should sit in this seat, the second seat, if you will, as George is calling it, the idea that in some states we're already seeing commercials about the doom and destruction of the world if, in fact, depending on which side of the fence you sit, the other guy gets in. Does that bother you at all?
I don't know that I would use the word bother, but maybe I should use that word. It does bother me, and as you say, it's on both sides, and they've been spending this money. It's not anything new. You know, the battle over these appointments to the circuit courts was very intense and very bitter, and that battle was about this upcoming battle when Rehnquist steps down and then potentially two other justices following him. This is what the battle has been about, and up until the decision late last week, I was convinced that it really was about Roe v. Wade, but it becomes much bigger. You know, the thing that's fascinating to me is that all of this money is being spent. People are very sure that there's going to be this huge ideological shift. But what was kind of interesting to me in the decision with the property rights last week was that I think it was three of the justices on who decided the case were Republican appointees. Is that, was it three or two? But, you know, it just, my point is that sometimes you appoint justices thinking that one thing is going to happen, and what we've seen is that people get into the chair, they take this role of being on the Supreme Court very seriously, and sometimes that ideological stuff goes away.
You're right, Laura, so far, but what they want to do this time, this is what's so key. They're saying we can't have another Blackmun. We can't have another Souter, Sandra Day O'Connor. And they are trying to get people as pure conservative as they can so they don't risk that. This is why this thing is so intense.
You're absolutely right, but they're not going to be able to do it. I mean, the Democratic strategy is quite clear, and I think that we've seen that Republicans thus far have not demonstrated the backbone or the cojones to really go to the mats. And when challenged, I think that they'll throw a fit, they'll huff and puff, and then they will put somebody through that is going to be less divisive, so to speak, and at least tolerable to the minority party.
Laura, you're confusing Democrats with Republicans. Admittedly, a bit Pollyanna on my side for this question, but it seems to me that these appointments, while always contentious and always politically fought, and certainly you had those who had competing interests who would push politicians to try to make the appointment that would best suit them, it does seem far more contentious and problematic now than ever before, with more groups and more monies being spent to try to buy ideology.
Absolutely. That's this last battle that we just saw over the filibuster issue is setting the stage for what I think is going to be the mother of all Supreme Court battles and when these vacancies do come up. And I don't see any compromise here. I think I agree with Mr. Phillips that we're going to have to that Democrats are going to really dig in their heels on this one, and they are not going to accept an extremely conservative figure. And one example of the debate within the Republican Party is over Alberto Gonzalez.
Exactly.
A lot of folks say that, you know, George Bush wants to have the first Hispanic appointee, and that is his pick. Even though many people see Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney general, as being someone who is very conservative on civil liberties issues and other issues, many of the conservative Republicans don't like him because they say he's soft on choice issues, for example. So you're talking about divisions even within their own party. I think Gonzalez can pass muster precisely because he's a Latino, but this is going to be a huge monster.
Bob Novak reported today, I think, that's the leak that...
And he is also suggest He's also suggesting that Rehnquist may not even be the first to go. That Rehnquist is really trying to hang on, and that in fact Senator Day O'Connor may be leaving because of her husband's illness. So I think it's too early to start predicting folks and where the checkers are going to get moved around.
A lot of these folks have been hanging on for a mighty long time to hang on to, quite frankly, their political bent and slant.
So Arlen Specter says that he saw Rehnquist recently and he looked very fit. And I thought, well, I guess as fit as an 80-year-old man with cancer can look.
Yeah, but we'll see how it all plays out. All right, let's turn our attention to Maryland and what is happening there. And we have seen this, quite frankly, throughout the country in terms of incentives, wooing teachers to come to particular school systems. But this is interesting by virtue of the fact that some of these neighborhoods have been touted as problematic, have been suggested as being, quote, too violent, and now the lure of teachers by giving them bonuses, by giving free rent in this case, by giving, there was one, a low-interest credit card, et cetera, et cetera. George Curry, does this speak to the idea of, quite frankly, first and foremost, how problematic in this case the school system can be, or does it speak to the idea of a smart school system who is just trying to bring and woo the best teacher they can get?
Well, I think it speaks of innovation. I spoke to National Urban School Board's meeting several months ago in San Diego, and I was amazed at the different ideas that they have for being innovative. They, in fact, in Chattanooga, for example, they match the poorest schools with the strongest teachers and give them bonuses for that. If test scores go up, they get certain bonuses. They get money, down payments for housing, these kinds of housing in inner city and these kinds of things. So I think that's a different way of approaching it. I think it's an excellent way. You're not going to have a whole lot of takers, but I think that it can do some good, and it does get us off dead center.
Now let us move to the idea of what is happening here in this Maryland complex. And it's an unusual deal that was actually cut by a teacher with a landlord in a troubled complex there. Five teachers from a nearby school can live there for free at the apartment complex as long as they keep their jobs and tutor neighborhood children, which was interesting because this is not the incentive from the school, but teachers actually working side deals, if you will. Ray Charles would be proud of them, I'm sure. But Laura, what's your thought?
I think the side deals are fine as long as, and it wasn't clear from the article that I read on this, that whether or not public funding is involved in this. But, you know, I think incentives are fine to improve communities. But when you start giving away free rent, I think that is a little bit misguided.
Laura, George Curry, and Joe, sorry I couldn't get you in on that last one, but greatly appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you.